So let's start. Welcome to the LSC for this public event. My name is Dr. Natalia Naqvi, and I'm an assistant professor in international political economy in the Department of International Relations. I'm very pleased to welcome Dr. Sungmin Rao, Dr. Boram Lee, and Ruafin Ma here tonight. So our speaker for tonight is Dr. Sungmin Rao. She is an associate professor of international relations and political science at the Graduate Institute of International and Development Studies in Geneva. Her research bridges international and comparative political economy with a focus on labor, and her newest book, Atomized Incorporation, Chinese Workers and the Aftermath of China's Rise, examines the political implications of labor unrest by investigating marginalized workers' perceptions, beliefs, and behavior within factories. For our discussants, we have Dr. Boram Lee, who is also an assistant professor of international political economy in the International Relations Department. Her research interests lie in how value-based issues affect economic globalization. Her projects investigate when governments enforce global corporate norms and discipline companies for breaking those norms, and whether legislators respond to changing public opinion on trade, and how governments choose different trade barriers to protect the environment. Ruafin Ma is a PhD student in the government department at Harvard. He is also a graduate affiliate at the Institute for Quantitative Social Science and the Weatherhead Center. His research interests include human rights, labor rights, and international organizations. He uses machine learning and network analysis for his research, and his dissertation focuses on how the information network across IOs promotes international human rights and labor rights standards. So before we start the talk, I just have some quick housekeeping things. For those using X, formerly Twitter, or using Blue Sky, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSCEvents. The event is being recorded and will be made available as a podcast online. And as usual, there will be a chance for you to put your questions to the panel after the presentation. I'll let you know when we open the floor for questions. If you raise your hand, and then when I indicate, the roving mic will reach you, and then please pose your question after the mic reaches you. Please don't forget to provide your name and affiliation before posing your question, and please keep your question brief so that we can get as many as possible. Okay, with that, we can begin the talk.
Thank you.
Hello, everyone. Is this an okay volume for everyone? Yeah, okay, great. Thank you for my book talk titled Atomized Incorporation, Chinese Workers and the Aftermath of China's Rise. I'm very happy to introduce my book. The book came out actually more than a year ago, but there was a period of time that I didn't want to talk about my book. So I came back with a renewed passion, and there will be a paperback version of the book available within a month, so I think this is a great timing. So I'd like to give you a very brief overview first. So the book is, as Talia introduced in the beginning, about protest behavior of migrant workers in China. And migrant workers here, I mean mostly internal migrant workers. They're coming from rural areas in China. And this book was written in a context where labor protests for higher wages were very prevalent. And I'm going to explain why this is an important context to remember. And I address the question of what is the political, socio-political implications of widespread labor unrest in China. And I argue that this protest do demobilize labor in terms of undermining the threat of organized labor protests. But at the same time, they do not depoliticize labor discontent. And this is based on the major finding that these protests reward the workers with mobilizational resources, but the most aggrieved workers actually don't have those resources. If you look at this figure, you'll see that in the early 2000s, there were a larger percentage of labor protests for higher wages, whereas increasingly the labor protests are for wage arrears. In the early 2000s, when I started my research, this was a period where a lot of scholars and observers and activists were contemplating whether we are looking at a new era of labor unrest and collective action in China. Because most of the protests in the previous time were really about the violations of labor laws, written labor laws, so meeting the legal minimum. Whereas the protests that occurred during the early 2000s were about getting more than the legal minimum. So my factory pays the legal minimum wage, but I want higher wages. So the benefits that are not really guaranteed by the law, I want those because I have the right for that. So we kind of witnessed the growth of a new kind of labor unrest, and that's when all these debates about what this means for China were really widespread. And this type of protests, a lot of scholars labeled as interest-based protests as opposed to right-based protests. And I'd like to introduce two cases of labor protests that were very influential. The first protest occurred at Honda factory in China. And this was a very important protest in the sense that it led to more than 50 automobile factories in the region going on a strike. So there was a chain effect. And the next protest that we see on the picture is perhaps the largest protest of migrant workers in terms of the number in Dongguan, at the world's largest shoemaking factory. And it involved between 30 to 50,000 workers, at least. So it was a huge protest and was also, at the time, reported by the Chinese official TV media in English, which is a very rare thing to do. And that is perhaps because the BBC reporter was on the scene reporting the protests and they felt the need to control the public opinion. So they had their own version coverage of the incident. So what is very interesting during this time was that most of the protests were tolerated. So it was very few, there were very few cases of workers being arrested. And in many cases, workers' protests led to some rate of success. So when I was talking with a former trade union member, which is also a government body in China, in Guangzhou, and he estimated around 80% of the labor strikes were ending in success on the part of workers. So at that time, then secretary of the trade union saying that we believe that the demands of the workers are justified, but we hope that such economic disputes do not move into political incidents. So there's one standard already that they use, the government uses, to discern what is a good protest and a bad protest. So an economic protest is a tolerable protest. The second criteria was whether the protest was occurring within the physical boundary of the factory or is actually over flowing into the streets or even to the government offices. So as long as there is no marching, walkouts, or playing of politics or destruction of machinery, then the protests are tolerable. And finally, he also affirmed that no worker during this strike wave of the Guangzhou automobiles strike, no one was dismissed, and there was no arrest. So this raises an interesting question in terms of what labor unrest usually means for political resilience in authoritarian regimes. So based on historical analysis, a lot of scholars have argued that labor unrest is something that authoritarian regimes should be most concerned about because of labor's sheer size and capacity to disrupt economy and society. And in China, that view was also present. But at the same time, some other scholars see that protest in China is actually a sign of resilience, the regime's resilience, rather than weakness. Because these protests are very much depoliticized. They're usually about economic gains, very small economic gains, and then short-lived. And then there is also the argument that these protests function either as a safety valve or control burn, so that those who have grievances about the regime might be satisfied with a very small economic gain and would not radicalize their demands. And finally, there is an argument that this protest functioned as a device to gather information for the regime. So as long as these protests can be managed within certain limit, then it's actually helpful for the regime to let people to protest so that they know where and to what extent grievances exist. And my work is directly related to this debate. So I'd like to first theorize state labor relations in China. And I theorize it as with the term atomized incorporation, which is also the title of my book. And in hindsight, maybe I should have chosen a different title because it's not very intuitive to a lot of people. But atomized incorporation, as you can see, is a combination of two different strategies, which is atomization and incorporation. So I define atomized incorporation based on two different criteria. One is that atomized incorporation has an incorporating element, which is that it brings the demands and interests of a formerly excluded group into the policymaking process. And there will be some demands of this group met through the process. And then it also creates new channels of claim making. But the important thing is that the channels are atomized for atomized individuals or groups. So there is no bargaining taking place between organized labor, organized groups, and the state. What this means is that there is definitely the bottom-up fitting to the policy process, because the workers and individuals need to make claims through either protests or through the petitioning or the letters and visits. But ultimately, the decision is top-down, because it's not that the labor leaders and the regime are sitting at the same table and negotiating in an open manner. Most of the bargaining is taking place in a particularistic way, and it's very difficult for workers to organize their demands. So there is an absence of organization. And it is not a very new concept in China that workers are either atomized or there's some accommodation of workers' demands. But what I try to do is combining these two seemingly conflicting goals, right? So how do you atomize people at the same time trying to meet their demands to some extent? Because usually when authoritarian regimes try to do that, they adopt state corporatism, which is you organize people and then negotiate with the leaders. But here, you don't have a leader. There is no mechanism of organization. I mean, of course, there is a trade union in China, which is an extended government body. And I can discuss why it's not a representative organization for a lot of workers in the Q&A if anyone is interested. So when you try to meet some of the demands of the workers then, it poses a challenge, right? How do you meet demands of a group that is not organized? And atomized incorporation is one way to do that, by opening up a channel for multiple and hundreds of individual or small group claim making. So the reason why I suggest that atomized incorporation reflects the specific context of the time is because even though a lot of people argue that, okay, like China has been atomizing people and then meeting some of workers' demands along the way, it has not always been the case. So until 1990s, the most of the approach to migrant labor specifically could be described as just exclusion and coercion. It was only since the early 2000s that the government started to show a shift in their approach to managing migrant workers. And that is because there were structural economic changes that are happening in the labor market. One was that because China experienced exponential economic growth, especially capital accumulation in urban industrial sectors, the expansion already absorbed most of the surplus labor from rural areas. So a lot of factories started to experience very acute labor shortage and turnover. And it was, you know, helpful for me because I got recruited all the time as a worker. Yeah. But what this meant that is that a lot of the industry that used to produce a lot of profits, especially taxes for the government, were not making money. And therefore, they were taking up a lot of space, especially the land, that they were they could rent for almost free or at a very minimal rate earlier on in the early phase of the globalization and industrialization. But they no longer give the returns to these governments. And the second factor is that worker structure of power also have gained because of the labor shortage. And at the same time, workers became more educated and had a very different sets of standards for their social well-being. So these migrant workers were born in the 90s, for example, have a very different understanding of the world and how they are situated in that world compared to the migrant workers who were born in earlier earlier era. So because of this combination of changes, there is a changing incentive for the local government, but also changing incentive for the workers. And then at the same time, this new generation of workers were still dealing with the legacies of a very discriminatory policies toward migrant workers. So there is this hukou system in China where if you're born with rural hukou and you go to urban area for work, you are mostly treated as an illegal immigrant. So for example, until 2004, there were police just walking around and then checking people's documents on the streets. And if you are found without either job or residential place or income, then you were placed in deportation centers. And then finally, you were deported to your rural village. So it was a very strict mobility control system. And of course, in 2004, that law was abolished because there wasn't a death of a student involved. But the social legacies of the policy still persist. So a lot of workers find it difficult to integrate to urban areas, either due to the social perception, but also because some of the public goods are still only reserved for urban workers or local workers. For example, if you have kids, your kids cannot go to a public school if you're not from the local area. So these problems together meant that the workers' discontent about how the society treats them actually has grown over time. And finally, as I said, there was this generational change that contributed to this new context. So in a way, then it means that China was experiencing a very rapid structural changes in the labor market. So they need to change their development path so that they get out of this very labor-intensive production, because that era is already gone with the labor shortages and the wages going up. And then like workers are becoming much more discontent and disgruntled. So how do you actually balance all this together in this new context has become a very important question. So the government responded with what I call is atomized incorporation. And more specifically, it was either by tolerating this protest when they make demands about their wages at the specific factory, then usually the local government will tolerate it. And then there were a series of pro-labor laws that mostly targeted migrant workers. And then there was a huge investment in educating workers about legal rights. So encourage workers to report legal violations at their workplace if they see any. And then there was limited use of police repression. But at the same time, automation still was ongoing in the sense that if there is any sign of cross-factory alliance or engagement of outside people, if, for example, activists or NGO workers, in these collective action incidents, then the regime actually came back with a very strong repression. So in other words, the repression became very selective whenever the collective action or the incident crossed the boundary of what they think is a tolerable protest. So I am looking at what are the consequences of managing these two conflicting goals, and then why, what it means when workers engage in protests, and does it actually depoliticize their discontent? And finally, at the meso level, like what are the firms that are experiencing protests versus what are the firms that are not? And I did like a roughly 2 years of fieldwork in China in two major industrial clusters, in addition to one inland province, and I can explain in more details if there are any question at the end. And then I did some participation observation in NGOs and protest scenes. And then I conducted my original survey data collection in a city, industrial city in Guangdong province, which is Shenzhen. And then collected worker surveys based on 156 factories. And finally, I also used some secondhand data through a database called the China Labor Bulletin Strike Map, where they collect information about labor strikes taking place based on workers' report of the strikes online. And most of the workers use social media in order to publicize their strikes, so it actually functions as a very useful data set. So first thing that I'd like to show you is the fact that a lot of workers are very discontent about central government. And this is very interesting given usually people's understanding of how workers view or how citizens view central government in China, because usually there is an idea that they blame the local government, they actually support central government. But on the left side, you see the data for the general production workers, and on the right, we see the data for the line supervisors. And I oversampled line supervisors from each factory because the line supervisors usually are the mobilizers or demobilizers of the collective action. So their views are very important. So on the left side of the graph, you can see that general production workers, it is true that they blame the firm and the workers themselves more than the local or central government. But at the absolute level, more than 60% of the workers say that central government is to be blamed for workers' plight. That is a little bit lower among line supervisors, but the difference isn't really substantial. And what is interesting is that for line supervisors, most of them said that the workers' plight is actually a responsibility of the workers themselves. And that is perhaps because line supervisors are the ones in the factory, they climb up the career ladder. They actually start from the general production worker and then get promoted. So actually they believe in their individual effort and competence in achieving upward mobility. But that cases are very rare. And then protesters, we look at the data for protesters, then the protesters actually blame the firm and not necessarily the government. So if you look at the left, right, lower left corner, you can see that protest behavior increases the blame attribution to firms, but you can look at the other upper two graphs and it shows that the protest behavior actually is negatively associated with blame attribution to the central and local government. So it's actually in line with a lot of the observations and insights among China scholars that the protesters actually are not the ones that are against the government, especially against the central government. They protest because they believe that the central government will react on their side. As I said, that the line supervisors are potential mobilizers in the sense that they have the capacity to mobilize workers to go on a strike. For example, if you're on a production line and there are like 100 workers, and line supervisors can just turn off the production line and everybody's on strike. And there, one of the cases of protests that I visited was among about like 500-600 workers factory, and then these line supervisors were very close to one another because they lived in the same residential complex together. And they worked for a longer time in the factory, which is very important because general production workers, because of the high turnover rates, have a very short tenure at a firm. So for example, if I can give you like an example, like when I was visiting an electronics factory, very large electronics factory, the manager was saying that if you hire 100 workers within 6 months, only two left, 90, 80, right? So, but then line supervisors actually stay in one firm for a long time. So in terms of social cohesion and network, it's very difficult for general production workers to cultivate that resource within that short period of time, whereas the line supervisors can do that because of their tenure and then their experience. But you can see that when I ask about the protest intention, then the line supervisors are much more conservative. They're much less willing to go on a protest than the general production workers, probably explaining why, despite the widespread discontent, we don't see protests occurring every day. If you look at the data across the firms, actually the law-abiding firms experienced more protests, not fewer protests. And usually when the media reports about labor protests in China, they always say like factories need to abide by laws. These legal violations of labor rights are leading to workers' protests. But in reality, more protests occurred at law-abiding firms. And then that is because law-abiding firms have a reason to abide laws in the first place. And there is very limited resources for example, Labor Inspection Bureau to inspect each factory in their jurisdiction and then make sure all the firms abide by labor laws. So absent this widespread monitoring and inspection, then why do firms abide by laws? It is because some firms believe that they're much more exposed to the reputational costs of not abiding by the laws. And as I said, that workers were getting trained in legal knowledge of what is their labor right. And therefore, workers could just call a hotline and then report their firm's legal violation of law. And if that happens, the Labor Inspection Bureau comes out and checks on the factory, right? And then many firms don't want that happen. Because one, they're stock listed or they're a large firm, everybody recognizes their brand, then there's much more to lose out of this than gain. So a lot of the big firms, large scale firms, and foreign invested firms were very cautious about violating a labor law. Probably one area of exception is working hours, because every factory violated working hours. But then like local governments also gave them sometimes very explicit leeway about that part of the law. But other parts of the law, whether it's minimum wage law or providing social insurance or paying overtime pay or paying double the salary during the weekends, these firms were expected to abide by these laws, and when the workers actually reported them, then the Labor Inspection Bureau would come out, and a lot of firm managers in these firms worry that it will tarnish their reputation, right? So the reason why workers also are more incentivized to go after, go on a protest at law-abiding firms is because firms' public exposure, the very reason that makes them abide by laws in the first place, give them a resource, an advantage. The workers at these law-abiding firms were more likely to believe that if they went on a strike, then their demands will be met. And then I've seen a lot of cases where workers actually contact media companies before they go on a strike. And the media companies pick up on the cases, especially large scale or well-known firms, because they are newsworthy. So they are present even on the first day of the strike to report on the scene. So these resources make workers feel confident. And this pursuit of interest-based goals usually also meant that instead of going to the government bureaus, like the Letters and Visits Bureau or Labor Bureau to make their claims, usually in this labor interest-based protest at law-abiding firms, the workers went out for the headquarters of the firms, the consumers, the public, the third-party actors that could influence the decision at the firm. And that is because if the firms are abiding by laws, going to the government bureaus doesn't really solve that, because the governments are only concerned with legal violations of labor laws. So this means that there is less reliance on public order disruption, such as marching to the bureaus of the government or blocking the road, which is also a common strategy in labor strikes. So which means that these protests have a less likelihood, less probability that breaching the physical boundary of the firm. In other words, the most common strategy involved for this interest-based protest about new firms or just labor strike within the factory. Whereas in non-law-abiding firms, other strategies involved, like marching to the street, going to the government bureaus, and then blocking the road. And these, all of these strategies are to draw the attention of the local government. And they, in the short term way, they are much more threatening to the local government than the strikes that stay within the boundary of the firms. And then it's also, therefore, shown that these interest-based protests are less likely to invite police repression because police usually doesn't care that much if the workers stay within the factory compound and then go on a strike. And then there's a lot of like interesting mobilization tactics that are used in these factories. For example, a lot of these law-abiding firms are foreign-owned firms, because foreign-owned firms have a higher reputational cost when they don't abide by labor laws. And then when I was doing my field work, it was also the time where there was a China and Japan disputes over an island, either called Dali Island or Senkaku Island, depending on which region you're talking about. But because of this Dali Island dispute, there were a lot of strikes taking place at Japanese factories. To some extent, it was anti-foreign protests out of like nationalistic sentiment. But my research also reveals that workers sometimes see this as an opportunity to talk about economic gains at their factory. And then a lot of the Japanese factories at that time, expecting that workers would go on a strike and then ask for higher wages, they actually like let workers go on a paid holidays for a week, in order to discourage them from striking for higher wages. And then this is a strike at the Dongguan, the one that I showed earlier in the shoe factory. And here you can see that on the right side, the manager, the Taiwanese manager, is like labeled as national traitor. And then if you actually help this Taiwanese people, like this, and not mainland people, then you're not gonna have any offspring in your lifetime. Kind of leaflets that were circulated in the strike scene in order to mobilize workers, appealing to their nationalism. And finally, workers at law-abiding firms were less likely to blame the central government, which also says that these interest-based protests that are seemingly more aggressive and proactive than the law-based protests actually were less threatening to workers, were less likely to invite police repression, and the workers themselves, even though they had more mobilizational resources to go on a strike because of the firm's exposure to the public and their newsworthiness, actually were less aggrieved about the central government. So in other words, the most aggrieved workers actually have a very hard time accessing the mobilizational resources for initiating or participating in labor strike. And workers who are aggrieved usually leave the factory very early because they don't like the labor conditions there. So usually their strategy is to choose for the horizontal mobility rather than vertical mobility. So they go around different factories, different regions, and then they realize, oh, like it's not a problem of the one factory or one region, it's a structural problem. But by the time they arrive at that realization, they don't really have the mobilization resources because they left the firm very early, so they don't have the social network, social resources, and at the same time, they're not necessarily working at these large-scale law-abiding firms, and that's probably why their grievances are higher, because their firms were worse than some of these law-abiding firms. So the conclusion is that the Atomizing Corporation is kind of a fire alarm system in the sense that when workers raise alarms, then the state responds, right? So what this means is that there is an uneven effect of the system on workers. So it is actually the better workers that have access to the system than others. And therefore, the atomizing cooperation materially co-ops the people with collective action resources, but it's not a way to inform the central government about where the most substantial grievances are located. And at the same time, it only incorporates workers as economic agents because the setup of the atomizing cooperation is in a way that workers can only raise very narrow economic gains in a given factory. They cannot really ask for about their social right, political right, or broader economic right. And therefore, it still denies a lot of the demands that arise from workers being also social and political beings. And therefore, it does not necessarily enhance workers' loyalty in the long run, because it's not really the narrow economic demands that are very important for the workers. It's more of a broader structural problems that you don't have upward mobility, you're discriminated, you seem the society is unfair. That's actually much more important for explaining why they have grievances with the central government. So it actually shows that it leaves a lot of grievances unaddressed. This leads to my next project, the current project that I'm doing right now. I'm examining a lot of the non-cooperation resistance of workers. So they don't really go on and protest and work like demand something on the street, but a lot of the young people retreat from paid work. So it's like a Tangping movement that is a very popular name in mainland China right now, which is translated as lying flat. It's like a commitment to do nothing. So a lot of workers retreat from the paid work. They don't get married, they don't want to have kids. So fertility rates are coming down. What I show is that, what I try to analyze in this work is that it's kind of a new way of resisting, even though workers do not necessarily feel that it is resistance. And it's very difficult to police because it's perceived as a personal choice. But it has consequences for the Chinese model of development, especially the very specific ways in China develop their capitalist system. And the right side of the book is written by a sociologist that were looking at this young workers, migrant workers in Shenzhen who only work like 2-3 days a week and then spend the rest of time just playing games and smoking. And that actually created a lot of discussion in China, because Chinese people, the typical image of migrant workers is that they really work hard and earn money and then try to get married and build a house in their village. But a lot of migrant workers also don't see that as a viable or even interesting way of moving forward. So they sometimes just, they're content with just 2-3 days of wage labor and don't want to really work hard or don't want to be productive or don't want to contribute to the building of the next great China, right? So that also poses some long-term questions, but I'm happy to address this in the Q&A. I'll stop my talk here, and any questions are welcome. Thank you.
Thank you. So for the discussion, should we start with Rufan and then Borum?
Thank you. Thank you, Sami, for the fascinating presentation, for Borum for inviting me to do this. I'm going to attempt, actually, let me sort of just time myself so I don't go over. I'm going to attempt to give a quick summary of this large book and then the very detailed nuanced presentation that Sami just gave. And then sort of pick up some of the highlights, really the sort of the theoretical and then methodological contributions that really should be highlighted and then praised, that all of the work and care and thought that went into this book, and then finally conclude with some sort of the comments that I think the book could it's not like it's necessarily missing, right? But sort of like different angles that could like, you know, further increase, enhance or sort of like nuance our understanding of like the picture of labor, state labor relations in China, and also maybe some sort of like future point questions for our musing. So, right, to me, I think like the book really sort of like tackles like two really interrelated questions, right? The first of which is sort of like a more of a descriptive task of like just figuring out, presenting like a coherent image of like answering how does China actually manage the workers' discontent. And I think here I largely basically agree with like the sort of like the sociological documentation that Dasami provides, that you know before the 2000s, it's mostly sort of like the state labor relations really managed, especially for migrant workers, is managed by you know coercive institutions, right? Things like hukou and other forms of sort of like a local institutions as well, right? Which for the most part, right, it's like a, especially since the you know the opening and the reform since like the late 70s and going into 80s and 90s, it's a crucial sort of a design that simultaneously ensures economic growth, right, and also keep migration on strictly under state's control, right, both of which are like states a very high in state's priority, right, during that period. But I think around 2000, right, as something documented, right, there's this structural change. Both sort of like coupled by, on the one hand, there's like this labor shortage in the labor intensive sector, especially in sort of like, you know, the coastal areas and in Guangdong province, where it's sort of like China's most important sort of like a region for manufacturing sector, right? And then there's sort of like this generational shift, right, in terms of like what the migrant worker actually want, right? There's like this growing discontent. I remember there was like a quote in some chapter 3 of the book, right? There is like, oh, like the newer generations of the China worker that were born in 80s and 90s, which is also, you know, the sort of like where around when I was born, are characterized by like three highs and one low. So we're like high education, high ambition, sort of like high standard, but like low in their like capacity to tolerate hardship, which I thought was like hitting a little bit too close to home. But I think that was sort of like a really sort of like a nice way of capturing like, right, like, you know, the sort of like the zeitgeist around, you know, this time where you have like a shortage of labor, right, and you have like this growing discontent, and which really just necessitates sort of like as China really need to figure out like a different way, right, to manage workers' discontent. And then like I think the path they take, as something sort of like illustrated, is the, what is so-called atomized incorporation, right? Again, characterized by two sides. For the most part, one is like, you know, you do have increasing progressive labor legislation, and that which allows within firm protest, right, allow, as long as the boundaries control at the firm level, for economic, purely economic demands concerning particular firms, rather, and on the other hand, like organized and politicized labor movement in particular are still faced strongly, are met with a strong governmental deterrence. And I think what is also somewhat like, sort of like towards the end of the book, right, and then there was a more discussion during what is the state's labor relation looks like under, you know, the Xi Jinping era, which is sort of like, I think, characterized by like, you know, more atomization and less incorporation, which I also agree, right, there's like this increased frequency in crackdowns, both in the labor organizations, labor groups, and also civil societies, right, NGOs. So as a result, there's like this rise in new forms of labor non-cooperation, right? So I think this is, for me, this is like a very convincing description of like what goes on in China, and especially how does the state relation, state labor relation evolves in China. And on the other hand, I think there's like this of a much more sort of like a social science evaluation that like, you know, whether the strategy of atomizing cooperation is actually successful, right? I think probably like most of questions in social science, right, that the answer is yes and no, right? One is like, on one hand, the labor protests are often depoliticized, right? Like they put more blames on the firms than the central government. And then and on the other hand, like workers actually, workers who participate do actually get like material benefit, right? So it seems like, you know, the state get what it wants and then the workers get what it wants, sort of like a happy story, right? But I think this is really sort of like to me, the sort of like the most insightful and then like sort of like the ingenious part of the theoretical contribution here is that it's actually there's a remains a large sort of like labor discontent that remains politicized, and precisely because of like as a result of this you know strategy that the state choose to manage its relation with labor, right? Because like the atomized incorporations as a strategy, right, disproportionately benefit a small segment of working population, right, both within firms and across firms. Right? Within firms, it is actually the workers that are more with higher level abilities, that have more resources, that are more likely to participate and benefit from these protests, right? And across firms, right, it's usually the workers in the more visible firm, right, I think what is called like a sort of like a firm, like places where there's more discursive sort of right resources, right? Essentially, that like the firms that are more likely to receive media attention, right? That are more salient, that receive more sort of like public scrutiny, right? Places like this that are more likely, workers are more likely to participate and benefit from protest. So I think what is really interesting and exciting about this framework, or it's like first of all, sort of like from a comparative politics standpoint, right? Sort of like extend beyond I think what's sort of like the last big thing, right? In labor study, which is like state corporatism, right? Which sort of argues that a predominant way in autocratic regimes that the way that state managed to manages its labor relation is through the control of labor union, right? Then the labor union then engage with the workers, so it sort of like become integrated as a whole. But sort of that strategy is sort of like more or less as somebody argues, right? It's infeasible in China precisely because like, first of all, well, the government doesn't really need to engage with the union's leader, right? Because the union leader themselves are part of the government, and also perhaps as a result, right? The workers themselves are also disinterested in engaging with the union because they know, okay, they, essentially you're just like part of government, right? Why would I entrust my interest with you to negotiate with government? And also, you know, at the same time, single union policy, right, that this China has held strong and fast about, is also at odds with creating competing competitions among unions, which is a common strategy that states who try to adopt like corporatism, sort of like corporatistic strategies usually resort to. And also, you know, like the sort of the atomized incorporation, because I think at first glance, to me, it read a lot like safety valves. So, oh yeah, like, you know, some people protest, they get what they want, and other people go home, right? That's sort of like, you know, bad for them. But I think it's sort of like it's more nuanced than that, and I think this is like really important to highlight, is that access to the strategy is uneven. Right, like the workers that are socially and economically more mobile are more likely to receive the benefits. We talk both across firms and within firms. Right, these workers are sort of like also like because of like they have high mobility, because of they have higher resources, are actually precisely the ones that are more likely to place blame on central government, as the you know the graphs previously have shown. So in addition, like there remains a large number of workers with growing social political grievances that have like no channels to express their demands. So I'm going to be a little bit quick here. Like these two issues, right? Like the workers that actually benefit tend to put blames more and more on the central government, and there are also like there's like a lot of like workers that the government left out that have like these occurring like grievances, right? These sort of are kind of like at the sort of like the paradoxical center of like the pitfall of like you know atomizing corporation as a strategy, right? Which leads to eventually to like as someone argues. Leads to this like more repressive approach in the Xi area, following like you know these essentially these discontents keeps bubbling up. Right, I'm gonna skip this, but I really just want to highlight this is really I think like the survey collection, right, the qualitative efforts, and then the fieldwork that went into this book is like truly sort of like you know like, fantastic, and especially as we were talking earlier, I don't think these type of work can be done again in China, in the context of China, and at least anytime soon. So this is really sort of like a gem, right? Like that kind of helps us to look into what has happened and help us understand sort of like where we come from. We're gonna talk about social desirability bias later, but not gonna talk about that. So I think I have like two major comments about like what is like sort of what I felt like is sort of like under discussed in the book. So first of all, I think like the alternative, right, that the book sort of like always allude to is like, oh, there's this issue that like if the government doesn't really address the workers sort of like discontent, right, there's gonna be an issue, right, because there's gonna be a risk of workers' movement that may harm the regime's legitimacy and even its survival, which I'm not completely sold on, this, like whether there was like not enough evidence to convince me that like the regime actually perceived this as a real threat. But like in the sense that there's always been this discussion that like there's a decline in the effectiveness of like labor-led sort of like social movement process, right? Like I think by like a raw count, that like, you know, Haggers, Kaufman did this like collection, sort of like this tally, right? That like labor-led social movement that lead ultimately to regime change hasn't really happened since 2000, but their data ended in 2010, right? And globally and in Asia, that hasn't happened in 1988. Right, so like how real the Chinese government is, right, like how serious it is treating this as a threat, I think it's a problem, it's a question that should be further sort of highlighted, right? It's like they're certainly alert that this is a problem, but like is this like a real threat? And more generally, right, among the workers that are not sort of like, you know, receive the benefit of incorporation, right? The question for them is that, you know, what is the incentive for the city to actually even considering extending the incorporation to the, like, since these are the workers that collectivization is most difficult, even like, you know, when the state is not intervened. And lastly, really quickly, right, I feel like there's like, I mean, I'm, you know, this is like a talk from the IR department. I feel like there's like sort of like a missing picture from the international, right? First of all, like at the beginning, the motivations of why China faces labor shortage is because, you know, there's like a sharp rise in the demand for labor-intensive jobs, right, as a result of international trade, as a result of like China joining the WTO, right? So sort of like alternative explanation for like, you know, why China later on moved away from automatic incorporation may not be just that like, oh, like there's more and more sort of like grievances, right? It could be that like, oh, China as like China sort of like moves up in its like global production, and it's, you know, we don't need to care about like, you know, these like cheap laborers for like demand, right? And also sort of like international monitoring, I think, plays a crucial role, both from issues organizations like WTO or the ILO, which I think sort of like is also like played sort of like a very marginal role in the picture here. Gonna leave it here, and I think overall, again, I can't highlight how much I enjoy reading this. I look forward to comments and to the discussion.
Thank you, Barb.
Yeah.
About 10 minutes. I'll put my hand up on your 10 minutes.
Thank you so much for those who came, and I see some of my students in my international trade course. Thank you for showing up. So I thought this was really well timed because this week I taught international trade and development, and last week I taught China. So my students should know pretty much like very well about this topic. But what I really liked about this book is that in international relations, we tend to talk about the rise of China as a black box, and like as if China is a monolith. But then Dr. Rowe's book actually
Dr. Rowe's book actually looks into China and helps IR scholars and students to learn what's happening within China. So I have very brief three comments, and the study was mainly conducted from 2012 to 2017, which is before the first, I mean, during the first Trump presidency, but also before his second presidency. So I'd like to situate the insights from this book into contemporary international relations and international politics. So first, it's related to what Rofan already mentioned, but I wanted to talk and discuss more about the industrial upgrading and its potential distributional consequences. So the book in one chapter talks about how the change of economic circumstances actually incentivize the central government and local governments to use labor laws and labor conditions as a tool to upgrade their own industries. So they kicked out or try to eliminate low value adding companies in their own localities by complaining or finding out that these companies are violating labor laws. So that was really interesting. And then like that incentives of those local and central governments aligned because and workers' incentives and those government's incentives aligned because the governments wanted to upgrade their industries. But at the same time, I was wondering how atomized incorporation would be politically compatible with a further and more intensive industrial upgrading. So in the short term, a lot of low-skilled factory workers must have lost their jobs in the process of intensive industrial upgrading, in the process of getting rid of inefficient and labor-intensive industries. So for the government and firms to incorporate labor demands, they would need some resources and just some form of compensation to those workers. Where do those money come from? And would it be possible to compensate workers in times of upgrading that may require massive readjustment and restructuring? So here we can actually think about the rise of DeepSeek, and now we are familiar with that company. And a lot of the industries that, the capital intensive industries that China is trying to promote are actually targeting to hire very high skilled and college educated workers. And then in those words, which Rofan just briefly mentioned, would the government have any incentive to listen to those low skilled factory workers anymore? So does that mean the death of atomized incorporation? Or would the government continue to use atomized incorporation towards high-skilled workers? So that was interesting. And second, I wanted to discuss the prospects for political change in the future. So it's interesting that Rofan also mentioned that these protests at factories don't really pose any, might not actually pose a serious political threat to the regime. But I was also, I don't know very much about China. I have very little knowledge about local like Chinese politics. But I was reminded of the 2022 nationwide protests against the government's zero COVID policies. And for in political science and comparative literature, for democratization or regime change to take place, many previous studies argued that there should be some sort of cross-class coalitions. So now this book looks at the incentives of those low-skilled and factory workers, but is it possible that high-skilled workers might join forces if there is a certain focal event that unites those different classes of workers? And I was also thinking about how the growth of high-tech and AI might or might not actually mobilize these different types of workers into the same coalition in support or in opposition to the government. And finally, the elephant in the room is the trade war with the United States. So chapter 5 actually shows nicely that workers who have participated in protests are less likely to blame their economic struggles to local and central governments and more likely to blame their companies for it. Now with the US-China trade war, the Chinese government can so easily pass the blame on the United States. And then China may feel less political pressure to accommodate workers because there is such a big target to pass the blame on. So what does that mean for the viability of this strategy of atomized incorporation? Would China feel the need to continue accommodate workers' demands, or can they just pass the blame on the US? Or alternatively, this may actually be a moment where the government might feel the pressure to provide a more comprehensive welfare plans or welfare state for the workers. But not knowing much about Chinese politics or politics in China, I was just speculating based on my very sparse knowledge, but I really enjoyed the book and learned a lot. Thank you.
Thank you. Can I just to get an idea of how many questions we have from the audience for now? Can just those of you? Okay, so while the audience thinks of a few more questions, would you like to take maybe 5 minutes? Not to respond to every discussions raised, but maybe just a few of them.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, if the audience thinks of their questions, then we can bring the mics.
Thanks a lot. Yeah, thank you for the discussion. That was very insightful. And it's always a pleasure if somebody actually reads my book, not just introduction chapter. So I think I like to comment and perhaps respond on the dimension of international, because both of you raised that part, and which is very interesting dimension, and I wish I could talk about more about that in my book. So yeah, it is true that the Chinese way of economic development cannot be separated from its integration into the global economic order and the rise as the world's manufacturer and then the export powerhouse. So therefore, what's happening in the international economy and what's happening in the domestic economy, especially the labor market, has been interacting with each other very closely. So one thing that I couldn't really emphasize more is that China, even during the Hu Jintao era, it really started to transition the economy away from export reliance. At least that was the intention. That is because of the financial crisis and then the realization that if the reliance is too high, then there will be too much of uncertainty domestically. So what the new development model was suggesting at the time was, one, industrial upgrading. We want to get out of this very low value-added export orientation. And then second, boost domestic consumptions. So in order to boost domestic consumptions, it meant that everybody needed to spend money, which means even workers had to have money, which means workers had to be paid, right? So what this meant is that there is a new policy goal in the sense that accommodating workers' demands is not only about local economic stability, but also about feeding workers and then growing out of this very low value-added labor so that they can become a consumer as well. The China no longer relies too much on selling their goods overseas. And what I would assume is that because of the trade war, it's gonna actually be more the case, that the policy will be reinforced, right? It's very interesting because China has been really focusing on taking care of customers in a way. So like in the Hu Jintao era, like or even like early periods of the Xi Jinping era, the ones who spent the most money on the social shopping website will actually receive a letter from the from the government officials praising their participation in the economy, right? So from this perspective, I think the AI would not necessarily mean that the local government or central government just neglect workers' demands and don't care about their economic situation, but I think they would have an additional incentive to actually like upgrade the skills and upgrade the quality of the labor for this group. What is also like developing in relations is that all these high-tech companies in China that are considered to be the best companies are mostly platform economy companies. And these platform economy companies rely heavily on migrant labor right now. Mm-hmm. If I go to like any China city, I see more delivery workers than pedestrians. Mm-hmm. It's like half of the city are delivery workers, and they're all migrant workers used to work in factories, right? So the jobs that disappeared in the manufacturing sector is actually a lot of them were replaced by this new platform economy. So the industrial structure got improved, that there was an upgrading, but in terms of the workers' quality of the job, I think it didn't really vary that much, yeah.
Okay, great. So does the audience want to raise your hand with questions? And once the mic comes, please don't forget to state your name and affiliation. Here?
Yeah, hi. Thank you for your really insightful presentation. I'm Zhi Wei from Department of Geography. I'm a PhD student in human geography in UCL. My thesis is particularly looking at the rural migrant workers in the Pearl River Delta region. So my question and the most struggling thing I find is that when I was doing my field work, most of the, my informants saying that they said the labor protests are not very common in recent years, and they are quite happy with their life currently. And also, it is true that they are in a very kind of precarity, or their labor rights and interests are violated. So I was just wondering, how could you explain this kind of phenomenon from your perspective? Thank you.
Are there any other questions right now? Yeah, here in front.
Thank you for your amazing presentation. My name is Olivia. I am a final year undergraduate student doing politics and IR at the LSE. I really appreciate you mentioning the platform economy towards the very end and how that replaced some of the low-skilled production and factory workers the jobs that were lost during the industrial upgrading. So I'm really interested in hearing how do you think this transition towards platform economy might affect the workers' collective action and organization that may occur, because under the platform economy, the workers cannot recognize a direct line supervisor. It's very hard for them to also talk face to face with their employers. So do you think this is gonna alleviate the tension between the labor and the direct kind of exploitation and working conditions they face? Or do you think this might divert the blame to structural issues and central government, and that can take the blame? Thank you.
Any other questions? Yeah, there at the back.
Hi, thank you for the lecture. I'm Tao from Imperial. I'm more curious about your research approach. You mentioned you collected surveys from the factories within China, and from my experience, factory workers are usually very reluctant to respond to these questionnaires to express what they truly think, and I'm very curious on how did you motivate them to express what they truly think and make the sampling representative of the large group of factory workers. Thank you.
Thanks. Sungmin, if you want to respond, and the discussants can also feel free to add their thoughts if they would like.
Sure, yeah. Thank you so much for these wonderful questions. I'll start with the first question about happy migrants and unhappy migrants. So I have a chapter on how the critical consciousness about the system and then the social and political grievances are generated through the workers' experience. And what I find is that, and I'm not sure about like the demographics of the workers you have talked with, the workers' experiences really matter. And I've actually come across quite a few workers who are quite happy with their life. And usually the workers that are younger or have a limited experience as a migrant worker, they usually come out and then they have like financial independence, and then they get by something on their own that gives a lot of contentment to them. Whereas like workers who've been experiencing different jobs, different regions, and accumulated experiences as a migrant worker, and then experiences mobility, then they start to feel like the life is not changing despite many years of working and in different places. At that time, an experienced worker would say like, oh, like, yeah, worker is hard, but I didn't even go to high school that well, so maybe like my education is why I can only take this low quality job. But then like, if you talk with the workers that have been to different places and took many jobs before, and they're like, you know, like, wherever you go, job is a job. And as a migrant worker, you can never really get out of this cycle of just circling through my like low quality jobs. And that's not my problem, right? It's not a farm problem. That's not a region problem. It's like just because we are like that, treated like that in the society, and that's where the critical consciousness comes from. So it is true that a significant number of workers still express satisfaction, but then there is also a critical portion of the workers, I think, who are eventually connecting dots about what's happening not only in their life, but every migrant worker's life, right? So that's something that I like to add. About the second question, it's very interesting how this the rise of platform economy and migrant workers moving the sectors to the platform economy changes the ways in which workers organize. And platform economy workers actually have organized strikes before. So like labor unrest in the platform economy is not unheard of. And there is a lot of, I think, studies that are investigating the labor conditions and precarity of the labor in platform economy. Thousands of workers are under the same so-called employer, although like based on the labor contract, it's not necessarily like that. They're actually designated self-employed, but you're using under one platform, like one app. So it means that if everybody stops working, that poses a lot of threats, right? So of course, but there is, as you said, there is a problem, always the difficulty of overcoming the challenge of organizing because there isn't much of the central organization. But one thing that I always notice whenever I go back to China recent years is that unlike a factory, like where most workers need to really focus on their work for 12 hours a day, you just have no time during the work hours, these workers spend a lot of time waiting. So if I go to McDonald's, then in front of the McDonald's, I see like tens of workers just waiting for their delivery. So there is much more interaction between workers, not necessarily focusing on the work itself. So I think that is also a little bit different from how social interactions happen compared to the factory. So that might contribute to their building up of social network and resources. But this, that's my speculation because I haven't really done like really rigorous analysis about this. But definitely that is something that's gonna be very important for the labor issues of migrant workers in the near future. And also like how China's new growth model based on this social media / platform economies will evolve over time. And the final question that I'd like to comment briefly, yes, workers are very tired at the end of their shift. So if I say like I want to do like a 30-minute survey, they don't like it. But at the same time, when I was doing my research, there were I would say that was a renaissance of labor studies in China. So there were a lot of scholars. We had a big community of scholars and students working on labor issues together. And workers were actually quite used to taking surveys because there were a lot of scholars who were interested in studying labor issues. So there were quite a lot of workers who weren't really questioning why we conduct surveys or what this is for, like, oh, another academic scholar trying to ask questions to me. And then we gave out like one towel. I don't know if there wasn't enough incentive. But one thing that I realized is that, and I did surveys with some of the students there, workers are very nice to students. They were very nice to me as a student. They always thought I was so poor. And they even refused to accept the towel because they thought like, oh, you don't have money. Why are you buying me towel? So yeah, it is true that it was relatively difficult to recruit workers, but not as much as how people would assume about interviewing factory workers, because a lot of the times we were actually, a lot of workers were quite happy to talk about their life and the workplace as soon as they're over that suspicion of what are you doing here.
Was that, did the discussants want to add anything? Or should we take more questions? Yeah? Questions from the audience? Over there.
Hi, my name is Matthew. Two questions, really. One is, you mentioned that many of the firms that law-abiding firms were more likely to have protests and they were more likely to be foreign-owned. Does that mean the tolerance of these protests is as much foreign policy as much as it is a domestic labor policy? And on a bit more light-hearted note, why towels as an incentive?
Did you want to introduce yourself as well?
Sorry, my name is Matthew. I'm not a student. I'm a journalist at Global, but I'm not here in any actual capacity.
That's good. If there are no other audience questions, then I'll abuse my position as chair and ask my questions. Oh, there is. Okay, after you.
Thank you for answering my previous question. I just haven't followed up. So I assume that you collected how people blame central government for their dissatisfaction, or blame the factory, or blame their line manager, or blame the regional manager from the regional government from the survey. And wouldn't these respondents worry that if they say in the survey that, oh, I blame the central bank government, and that's kind of like a political comment, and what they like, I was wondering what they worry that this is a political comment that may bring them into trouble and then make them less willing to state that they blame the central government in the survey, but more likely to state other parties to blame within the survey and hide their true thinkings. That's just my question. Thank you.
Okay. Oh, yeah. Over here.
Hi, I'm Timo. I'm IP student at LC. And my question is, why are migrant workers now only working 3 days? And why they're just for the rest of the time, they're just kind of smoking and doing, kind of spending free time? What's kind of the causes of why they are not doing that?
Sorry?
What are the causes why they're now only working 3 days and for the rest just chilling, basically?
The causes of why they're only working 3 days.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'll just throw in my question as well. This might just be out of my ignorance about the situation in China, but you spoke very little about labor unions, so it could... So how to do, I mean, and I think relatedly also I was a bit confused by what you mean by depoliticization. Mm-hmm. Like, do you understand it as just opposition to the central government? And is that the case because of the lack of labor unions? Mm-hmm. If they're not labor unions, then how are they striking? Like, what legal right do they have to strike if this is not unionized labor?
I see.
Yeah, you can go.
Yes. Thank you for this wonderful question. So the first question about, is this like policy toward foreign firms, not necessary workers in general? So that was my suspicion going into the research. And I think there is both part of it. There is a part where the local governments are a little bit more sensitive around the dealings of the workers at foreign-owned enterprises, because workers sometimes come back and say, like, you national trader, you're helping foreigners, right? But at the same time, I don't think it's entirely that story, because first, like, local governments, regardless of where the protest is taking place, once the protest is taking place, it's actually raising a bit of an alarm for their political performance. Because if there is a large-scale protest taking place in their jurisdiction, then it actually reflects really badly on the political performance within the party system, right? So there is a very detailed document. It's actually amazing that's made available public and online. It's very detailed documents of what bureaucrats are supposed to do when the labor strikes happen. And usually the criteria is like how many workers are involved, right? And then like if it's involving more than 100 workers, you have to respond within X minutes. If it's more than 500, you have to respond within X minutes. And then depending on the size of the labor strike, you also have all these different jurisdictions that should be involved, right? If it's like a small strike, then only the street level bureaucrats. If it's a larger strike, you have to really let know of the higher level government, et cetera. And then, like, there is also detailed guidelines on, like, depending on the strike's purpose, what kind of bureaus should be involved in the negotiation, right? So if it's social insurance, then the social security bureau should be involved in addition to the labor union, et cetera, right? So in a way that it's the ways that these protests are dealt with at the local level are very much institutionalized in a soft sense, right? So there is no like law, but there is the guideline that is published by the central government. So it's not essentially, I think, entirely foreign story, even though like the informal ways of working and negotiation on the ground might have the foreignness in influence. The second comment, it's actually interesting because going into China, I thought like a lot of people will be cautious or very sensitive around discussing central government or but not really. not really. And then like the workers were like talking everything, you know, like all the society, you know, like all these government people or like, but I do feel like they were sensitive around talking about their firm conditions. Because we were like very close to the factory compound and we were very cautious about not doing the survey right at the factory gate or the compound because then they get more influenced by the proximity. So we usually like, you know, ask people to move and then go somewhere else for taking the survey questions. There were more concerns about whether our manager would know this than like would the central government care, right? I think there is also this sense that like, oh, central government might not really care. they might not really. Why would they like chase this random migrant worker? You know, I think there is has that. But I think that the situation is very different now. Yeah, it's from when I conducted the survey. The third question about why workers only work 3 days. That was the entire question of these two sociologists. And I think that question itself also poses some questions around what was the norm around an understanding around Chinese workers, right? Because there is the image of workers like working really hard every day. So when workers only work 3 days, then it becomes a puzzle, like why, you know? And then what the book concludes is that it's not that the workers are hopeless or they don't actually have any hope or aspiration, but they just don't simply see a viable means to get there. So instead of striving, they chose to just enjoy the moment. And from their perspective, whether you do it or whether you strive, at the end, the consequence will be the same. Like you're just gonna be left with very little money or resources to build your life, right? And I think it's not like the most prevalent sentiment among the workers, but I think I think it's also a growing sentiment, not only among migrant workers, but also urban workers, which is part of the current project. And it's also because the youth unemployment rates out of college is very high right now. And then a lot of workers and students are out of the graduation, they cannot really find good job, right? So then like the myth around hard work as a part of your identity in China always has been, then you actually adopt a very normal life course, right? You college educated, work hard, get married, settle down, buy house, etc. But then every stage of that normal life course, there is huge competition, so people just don't want to be part of that race, right? And then the final question about labor unions and what it means to depoliticize. So labor unions in China are only monopoly unions, so there is no multiple labor unions, one that's controlled by the government. And then it's not that the labor unions don't represent labor interests at all, but it's a very much of a legal advice organization. So when strikes happen, labor unions, either at the firm, there is a presence of the organization within the firm and most firms too. The firm's labor union leader and then the strict district level labor union should be present and then negotiate. And then they usually try to channel workers' demands into courts, like labor mediation or some kind of legal channels, which means that they try to break down all these demands into individual courts filing. And so in that way, the depoliticization itself is actually interesting. And I talk about this briefly in the book, that technically speaking, and then, like, you know, it's like using also common sense, the economic matter and political matter are very much intertwined, right? So you can't really draw a boundary between this is economic and this is politics. But what I'm trying to say is that that's what the government has been trying to do. Like, they draw the boundary, this is economic and this is political, and you don't want to cross the line here, without really addressing the fact that politics influence their economic situation and vice versa, right? So in that way, I think what I'm trying to say is that the strategy hasn't been able to depoliticize in the way that the government is trying to achieve, right? But of course, like, in terms of the boundary, it's very blurry.
Okay, well, thank you so much. It's been a great pleasure to have the opportunity for both me and I think for all of you to listen to these speakers. Thanks to all of you in the audience who joined us today, and thank you to our speakers, Dr. Sugmin Rao, Dr. Boram Lee, and Ruafun Ma, for taking part. We're very grateful that you could find time for us in your busy schedules. If you could join me in a round of applause.